provided by Thomas Allgaier and Fennis, based on the most relevant posts on LinkedIn about M&A insights in CW 39 and 40. Fennis is a B2B market research company supporting M&A consultancies with a marketing competition perspective, for example, in commercial due diligences. This edition is brought to you by our partners Informa and Studio ZX. Don't miss out on their upcoming conferences, Super Return Middle East, Super Return Europe, and the 23rd German Corporate M&A Congress. Find the links to all three conferences in the description. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're jumping straight into the M&A and investment landscape. We've sifted through insights from professionals on LinkedIn, specifically from calendar weeks 39 and 40.
Yeah, and the goal here is pretty straightforward. We want to give you, if you're in strategy, PE, VC, or consulting, some actionable intelligence. We're looking past just the headlines to see where the money's really flowing, what buyers are actually valuing right now, and importantly, the new non-negotiables in diligence. Think tech, think governance.
So basically the stuff that matters, cutting through the noise.
Exactly. Actionable intelligence, not fluff. You get the shortcut to knowing what's really up.
Okay, let's dive into our first theme then. Strategic rationale and market dynamics. It feels like we're moving past hesitation towards, well, bigger moves.
That's definitely the feeling. The market seems to be shifting towards big bets. Frank Akila pointed this out. Overall deal volume might be down, but the aggregate value, that's up. Capital is concentrating, you know, fewer deals, but much larger, more transformative ones.
Right. So those small incremental deals just aren't cutting it anymore. The market wants more.
It seems so. Scott A. Scanlon observed this pressure on leadership to really produce returns, and Venus Kennedy and Richard Dorsett, they emphasized that companies going for transformational M&A are seeing much better shareholder returns. We're talking 2 to 3 times better than just incremental approaches. So yeah, it's about size and real impact now.
And we saw some big examples driving this consolidation, like in banking, Laura Huntley highlighted Fifth Third Comerica. That looked like pure scale play, right?
Absolutely. Building a massive regional player, getting complementary footprints, boosting that balance sheet resilience. In this kind of right environment, scale is safety.
And what about infrastructure and tech? That seems to be heating up massively.
Oh, definitely. And what's fascinating is how traditional M&A logic synergies, cost optimization is now being applied to, well, AI infrastructure. That huge $40 billion BlackRock GIP deal for Align Data Centers, Juan Ignacio Torricone was tracking this, it's a prime example. Data centers aren't just buildings anymore. They're critical AI assets, high multiple assets. Buyers are looking at the engine room of AI itself for traditional M&A value drivers.
Wow. So while those mega deals are reshaping the top end, there's also something interesting happening in the mid-market, isn't there, with family offices?
Yes, that's a really interesting trend. Tulio Hardemi and Taylor Perry noted their increasing traction, especially with the German Mittelstand. Founders seem to find them often a better cultural fit compared to PE or even strategics.
Why is that exactly? Is it just patience?
It's largely the evergreen capital. They think in generations, not just quarters. That offers huge flexibility for sellers. Think gradual exits, earnouts, structures that really protect the company's culture and legacy. It's a different mindset.
That flexibility must be a serious advantage. So switching back to founders prepping for an exit, what are the key lessons? Joe Lewin had some specific thoughts on what buyers value now.
Yeah, buyers want very specific value. It's not just growth for growth's sake. We saw Kami acquiring Book Creator. The driver there was consolidating 20 million users, less about the immediate revenue multiple.
Okay, so user base over pure financials in that case.
Or acquiring expertise, like Dane's Group buying TB8 Innovation. And here's a key takeaway. Embracing being, well, boring can be a strength. Predictable cash flows, stability that often beats high growth uncertainty. Drew F. had that sobering stat, didn't he? Consumer brands take, what, 8.5 years on average to reach a strategic acquisition?
8.5 years. Ouch. Definitely a long game.
You have to be prepared for that.
Okay, let's shift gears. Theme 2, deal execution, financials, and risk. The mechanics of getting a deal done and where things get sticky.
Right, and it often starts with the money, doesn't it? Specifically, that adjusted EBITDA number. Always a point of contention.
Dirk Salmer really broke that down well. The core issue is founders see their reported earnings, but buyers, they only care about what the business earns in their hands.
Exactly, which means normalization. And that can be, well, brutal.
Adjusting founder compensation if it's way above market, stripping out lifestyle expenses.
That fancy company retreat that a new owner just wouldn't pay for gets added back. They also look at R&D capitalization, potential synergies from redundant costs. It's about finding the true underlying earnings power for the buyer.
which directly ties into how much leverage a founder has. Alejandro Cremades was pretty insistent that founders need to master the M&A language.
They absolutely have to. It's not just jargon, it's about understanding the stakes.
So what specific language bits are most critical for a founder?
Knowing the core mechanics, like the difference between an asset sale and a stock sale, is huge, right? An asset deal usually protects the buyer more from past liabilities.
Whereas a stock deal might be better tax-wise for the seller, but the buyer inherits everything, warts and all.
Precisely. And understanding financial impact accretion versus dilution, does this deal actually add to the buyer's earnings per share immediately, or does it detract? If you don't get these basics, you lose control fast.
And that control vanishes even faster once the letter of intent, the LOI, is signed, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Craig R. Sager made a great point. The LOI is just a roadmap. It's not the final destination. Sellers really need to push hard on key terms before signing that exclusivity clause.
Because once you're exclusive, your leverage just tanks.
Completely. The buyer knows you can't shop the deal around. And Pat Linden had a stark warning, pushing hard issues off until later. For the seller, later usually means never. You lose the chance.
Okay, so internal friction aside, what about external risks? Dr. Angela Carrick pointed out 5 big challenges that often derail bank finance deals.
Yeah, these are serious hurdles. Things like regulatory compliance, antitrust, securities laws, that kind of thing. Then there are the inevitable fights over risk allocation, like indemnification clauses. And cross-border complexity is a growing headache. Dealing with different accounting standards, GAAP versus IFRS.
Right. Just to clarify for listeners, GAAP is the U.S. standard. IFRS is more global. And they treat things like revenue recognition or goodwill quite differently, don't they?
Exactly. So the same company's financials can look materially different depending on which lens the buyer applies. It's not just translation. It impacts the economics. Plus, you have all the cross-border tax minefields.
And Seema Dubé reminded us about the classic legal deal breakers, too.
Still relevant. Regulatory failures, sure. Unresolved litigation, definitely. And, crucially, unclear IP ownership. If the buyer isn't sure you actually own the intellectual property you're selling, the deal just stops cold.
Makes sense. Okay, let's pivot to theme 3, the AI and technology lens. This feels less like a nice to have and more like a must have now.
It really does. AI is becoming central to deal strategy and diligence. Per Blomqvist noted that embedding AI right from the start, from deal inception, can seriously accelerate realizing those synergies.
And the way enterprise value itself is shifting.
That's a key point. Teddy Romana Cassina used a great analogy. You know ISO 27001, that secures the vault, your data. But the new global AI governance standard, ISO IEC 42001, that secures the algorithm. And that's where more and more enterprise value actually resides now, the intelligence, not just the data store.
That's a powerful way to put it. But how real is that ISO 42001 impact today? Can a lack of that specific standard really knock 10-20% off valuation right now? Seems steep.
Well, according to Romana Cassina, it can. And the reason is inherited liability. When due diligence flags major AI governance gaps, maybe biased algorithms, lack of transparency, buyers inherit risks they can't easily price. Regulators are watching this space closely. So that lack of a governance shield like 42001 aims to provide, it introduces uncertainty. And markets hate uncertainty. That's where the potential valuation hit comes from. It's becoming a real factor.
Okay, fair enough. So if buyers are scrutinizing AI, what are the common mistakes they're making in diligence? Are they getting dazzled by the hype?
That's definitely one risk Pani Veerafan highlighted. Buyers sometimes lack the deep technical expertise to properly assess AI capabilities. They might overpay for something that's frankly just a sophisticated rules engine, not true AI.
So misjudging the tech itself. What else?
They might also overlook genuine AI-driven value creation opportunities. Things like hyper-personalized customer experiences or really intelligent process automation that could unlock significant value post-acquisition. Acquirers need to demand solid proof of unique tech differentiation and, crucially, proprietary data. That's how you separate the real AI advantage from the marketing fluff.
Got it. Deep technical scrutiny is key. All right, theme 4. Integration, people, and value capture. We hear it all the time. Deals die in integration.
It's the classic M&A graveyard, isn't it? Monica Chance observed that poor planning and those inevitable cultural clashes are often the silent killers of deal value.
So what do the winners do differently? How do they navigate this?
It boils down to treating integration as a core discipline right from the beginning. Thomas H. Kessler stressed this. CEOs should run due diligence and integration as one single continuous process. Unified leadership is key. You can't just hand it off. Every synergy you identify in diligence needs an owner, needs a plan, needs a measurable KPI for the integration phase. It has to be seamless.
And what about managing the human element? Things like misaligned incentives, especially with earnouts.
Ah, earnouts. Eilis Shipley detailed this perfectly. They're meant to align incentives, right? But often they create massive friction. The seller feels like the buyer takes away the tools, maybe budget, maybe key people needed to actually hit those earnout targets post-close. So that alignment on what winning looks like has to happen up front, or it breeds resentment.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm. And the overall negotiation tone matters too.
Hugely. Lisa Martin emphasized avoiding that winner-takes-all mentality. You need to preserve the relationship for integration to work. You can't beat them up in negotiation and then expect full cooperation afterwards.
And Jeff Jones added that communication is critical. Silence kills deals. You build confidence through being responsive, being honest, even when the news isn't great.
Absolutely. Then there's the operational side. Srimoy D pointed out that mastering post-merger supply chain integration isn't just operational, it's strategic. And get this, Matteo Mochi showed that procurement, if handled strategically, can unlock up to one-third of total M&A synergies.
Wow, one-third from procurement alone, that's massive.
It is, but it requires focus and expertise. Which brings us to talent. Omer F. Guven advocated for more flexible talent models, using specialized freelancers, for instance, to scale deal teams quickly and efficiently. It's kind of an evolution in managing deal capacity. So before we wrap this up, let's leave you with a final thought, something pretty provocative that links that announced deal value to what's actually realized. We see these huge deal headlines, right? Especially in biopharma, often featuring massive milestone payments way down the line, making the total value look enormous.
Yeah, those multi-billion dollar figures often hinge on future success.
Exactly. But Vladimir Varshev ran the numbers. Historically, only about 19% of those biopharma milestone payments are actually ever paid out.
Wow, only 19%. Seriously, that completely reframes how you should look at those massive headline deal values.
It really does. It starkly highlights the gap between the announced value and the total realized value. That's the crucial difference, isn't it? The difference between just a great headline and, well, a great actual return.
A sobering but critical point. Okay, that brings us to the end of this deep dive. If you enjoyed this episode, new episodes drop every 2 weeks. Also, check out our other editions on private equity, venture capital, and strategy and consulting. Thank you for diving deep with us today. Be sure to subscribe for more actionable insights like these.